You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to yet another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. Hamish, what's cracking, my friend?
Not a lot. Well, actually, there is a lot this week. Something did happen. I bought a new camera, which just arrived this morning.
It's exciting. Tell us about it. We were just talking a little bit off air before, but tell us about it.
Yeah, so I bought a Sony A7S III. And it's quite a new Sony camera, and it's definitely overkill for the type of content that we create, but I'm very, very excited to
Are you going to try and push yourself and make different content, or are you still just going to be talking head kind of videos?
I don't know. I do have an interest in kind of making other content, and maybe I won't post it on the channel, but I'll probably make some other stuff. And
suppose you can always just take it on holidays and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that too. Yeah, exactly. No, I'm very excited. I don't have a lens for it yet though, so I kind of just have to sit here and look at it for the next couple of days until my lens arrives.
You can't do much with a camera without a lens.
No.
I wonder how many people have, probably not many, a camera is a big purchase. I wonder how many people have bought a camera and then been like, wait, this doesn't come with a lens?
Is this thing on?
I've realized they're only halfway there in terms of cost and everything else.
That would not be
fun.
Yeah. Oh dear. What's happening?
If you drop like multiple thousands of dollars on a camera, some people might expect that it comes with a lens. It's like, nope. No, it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the entry ones do.
Those kits, don't they?
Yeah.
I hope you get your lens soon and you can go and play around with your brand new camera.
Yes, I'm very
excited. Record some beautiful slow motion 4K footage. I don't know, if it's a hot day, let the dog play in the sprinkler and then record her shaking herself when in 4K slow motion.
Exactly.
That'd be pretty crazy. Yeah. What do we got to talk about? We got a lot to talk about today. Warren Buffett, letter to shareholders that came out. We're going to be talking about 13Fs collectively. Charlie Munger did an interview. Well, not an interview. This was the annual meeting, wasn't it? For the Daily Journal. We got a couple of other bits and pieces to talk about. Lots of Q&A questions as well. Let's jump into it.
Yeah. So today's episode is sponsored by ShareSight, and ShareSight is an application that I've personally been using over the past few years in order to track the performance of my stock portfolio. And you can use it to track all of the different types of gains that you experience as an investor. So capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans on your individual businesses or on index funds, then it will do all of those calculations for you, regardless of what type of reinvestment plan it is as well. Currency gains if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies. And then the main reason why I use it is when it comes to tax time. So ShareSight generates up to 10 different reports that can be used at tax time to work out things such as your capital gains, dividend income, and more. And at the moment, you can try ShareSight for free by heading over to ShareSight.com/Young Investors. That's site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSight.com/Young Investors. So you can use that link to sign up to a free plan. But if you want to sign up to a paid plan for more features, then you can also use that link to get 4 months off a yearly subscription. So go check it out if you're interested.
Sweet. I got an update on GameStop. You remember last week we made our predictions where GameStop was going to be?
Oh, no.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember what you said?
I don't know. It was low though.
You said 45.
Like, right. Okay. Yeah.
You said 45. I said 60. I went back and listened to it this morning just to make sure. And GameStop is not at 45. It is not at 60. It's currently sitting at $124 per share.
God damn it. What was it at when we made the predictions? I can't even remember what it was at. Was it 150 or something? Or
No, because it was at like 90 or something. Oh, okay. And then after hours, it was up, at the time, it was up 80% after hours or something. Okay. So it was up in the hundreds. But that didn't last in the end. That after hours trading didn't hold. But yeah, currently at $124. So we were both wrong there quite considerably. I was closer. I'll take that as a win.
Yeah. You know, I saw a news story this morning that kind of made me feel as though this business that we spoke about last year, before all of this Wall Street Bets stuff has happened over the past couple of months, I feel like this stock could be the original meme stock. Do you remember Hertz? Do you remember Hertz? Do you remember that company?
Yes. Oh my gosh, I do remember that kerfuffle, and we did talk about it, didn't we?
We did, yeah. So we spoke about it. It was a really big deal. No one really kind of referred to it as a, air quote, meme stock at the time, because that has only kind of just happened. That term has only really come up over the past couple of months due to Wall Street Bets. Yeah. But it really has a lot of a similar characteristics, and there was something that happened this week in regards to that company. So I thought maybe we could talk about it. So what happened was that the company Hertz is was a struggling car rental company. And in early 2020, they filed for bankruptcy. So very similar to a lot of the companies that are getting a lot of speculative people gambling on them at the moment. It was a business that was, you know, destined to fail, basically. And I was looking at the stock chart for the business leading up to when they filed for bankruptcy. The stock fell from $100 to 50 cents a share.
That's right.
Which is... yeah, insane. So $100 was their peak. I think it was a few years ago. And they dropped literally 99.5% till their bankruptcy. But
to be fair, yeah, they were going bankrupt. They were going through bankruptcy proceeds. Didn't they do like a last ditch effort to try and raise some money? They tried to sell some shares or something like that?
Yeah.
Not sure if I'm remembering that right. It was like, if they could sell enough, then they would avoid bankruptcy. But if not, then they would go bust or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. You're remembering that exactly right. So what basically happened was, because the stock was just so beaten down, for some reason, randomly, it kind of started to pick up in popularity on apps like Robinhood. And the stock actually surged 900% in 2 weeks. And it was also right around that time that the company asked the courts, because they're in bankruptcy, right? The company's gone bankrupt. They don't have any money. They asked the courts if they could sell more shares to investors because the stock was surging.
Wow. Which
is
after the 900% gain.
I think it was during it. I don't know if it was after the entire 900%. I'm not exactly sure
still,
when it was.
Why not? Give it a shot. Give it a shot, I say.
Yeah. I mean, and we were talking about, like, is that even ethical? Like, we're talking about people who are just retail investors. A lot of people on Robinhood are investing for the first time, just gambling around money. And this company is trying to just raise capital on a stock that, you know, had just fallen 99%. But yeah, very interesting story. So I thought, you know, I saw a news story this week about what happened to this business, so that we can kind of get a snapshot of what happens to some of these businesses. So the bankruptcy proceedings finished up this week, or are finishing up, and the company has been able to reorganize themselves, and they've sold themselves to new investors for $5 billion. So they got quite a substantial amount of money out of
$5 billion.
Yeah, out of new investors. And that $5 billion will be used to pay off the first and second lien creditors, which are basically the creditors that are first and second in line for what's left over for the business. Because, of course, when the business goes into bankruptcy, they might have some assets, or they might get money from new investors, like in this case. And it's not going to be enough to pay everybody. They can't satisfy everyone. So they have kind of the first rank who gets the first bit of assets. And then if there's more left over, who gets the second bit and that sort of thing. So,
right. Okay. And then shareholders come last.
And shareholders are always last. Unfortunately, in this case, shareholders will receive nothing. The business is being sold to new investors. So the old investors who held the stock have lost everything, unfortunately. And I think it's important to kind of highlight that the reality of most of the stocks that go through this kind of frenzy, something, whether it's GameStop, I think GameStop's probably in better shape than Hertz, for example. But a lot of these businesses that people focus on are businesses that have had their stock prices go down 90%, 95% because the business has a very high chance of failing. And this case, this was one of the businesses that ended up failing. Well, I mean, they got new investors, but the way I would describe I would describe failure as the shareholders being wiped out. So,
absolutely, yeah. From an investing standpoint, it was a failure.
Correct. Yeah.
Like same thing. You'd say Virgin Australia was a failure, although it still exists. It wiped out all the shareholders, right?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, well, that's very interesting, man. That's really jogging my memory back. That was ridiculous. I remember at the time we were just so confused because it's like everybody that was buying into this capital raise is like, you're basically betting that this company, first of all, is not going to go bankrupt. It just seemed like an extremely risky bet to make from our long-term investing standpoint.
It's one of those businesses where you have to imagine that the vast majority of people investing in the company or buying the stock are just buying it on a speculation, on a short-term play.
Just having a gamble.
Not that they actually think there's a reasonable chance that the business survives long-term or even that they've looked into that. So,
And there are investors that like, that's their whole strategy. They just look at companies that are on the verge of bankruptcy and just kind of make appropriate bets according to what they believe will go down after looking at who needs to be paid back and what their assets are and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which I find really interesting. That sounds way too difficult and too risky for me. But I think those people do it in a diversified way. They try and find a lot of these companies that are in these positions and make their bets accordingly. Because I mean, if they get it, you're right. Like in this case, the stock fell from $100 to 50 cents. So it was almost worthless based from where it was. So if they can pull through, then obviously they can make substantial, investors could make substantial returns. But it's obviously very risky and you have to know what you're doing. And it's something that I do not think I could do at all.
No, it's it's a special type of skill. I mean, some people just have expertise in that, assessing what assets are worth on the balance sheet and what debts need to be paid and can something be salvaged here
I guess it's all about playing within your circle of competence. Yeah. And that's just not in mine.
Yeah, that's definitely well outside of mine.
Absolutely.
I prefer quite the opposite. I prefer companies that just don't have any debt. I don't want to have to assess when it's due and what the interest rate on it is and all of those things. I'd prefer if they didn't have any.
Yeah.
That will
lots of cash flows coming in and no debts.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that would be ideal. And pay through your teeth to own one of those companies.
Yeah, unfortunately, most of the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. All right, what should we talk about next?
We're
going to talk about Buffett.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, what happened with Buffett this week?
Oh, a lot happened with Buffett this week. Oh, let me tell you. No, not really. So 2020 is done and dusted. Wow, we're into March already of 2021. That's pretty insane. So Buffett just this week released his annual letter to Berkshire Hathaway shareholders. This was for 2020. And I was like, you got to read, if you're a long-term value investor, this is like required reading, right? If you did a university course on long-term value investing, the required reading for your classes would be Buffett's annual letters to shareholders. they tell you so much. Like you can go back since, I believe it's 1965, he's done one every single year. And there's I'm not telling you anything new because I reckon you've probably read most of them, but there's so much to learn about how Warren Buffett thinks, how he applies his investing strategy, how he treats, shareholders of his company and, looking at what a good manager looks like. There's just so much to learn.
Yeah.
I think you would agree definitely on that.
Oh, certainly. Particularly if you have an interest in the businesses that Berkshire also owns, like insurance, for example. I was reading one just the other day, the 1978 letter, and there's not a whole lot of kind of general investing principle stuff in there. There is some of it, but even just the bits on the insurance industry specifically are so interesting because he talks so honestly about what is happening. Oh, we'd had a great year this year. Premiums were up substantially while the amount, I don't even know much about insurance, but the amount of claims that were like made were low. We don't expect that to continue. That'll come off in the next year. Like, it's just an honest explanation of what's happening in the industry. And even that can be really, really valuable just to see, because it's so rare. Usually the CEO just chirps on about how good everything is and how good everything is going to stay forever, which is, it's so refreshing.
It is. It's very, and I'm just so glad that he's never lost his way. He's always been the same Warren Buffett, which is just, it's really fantastic. But if we get into the actual substance of the shareholder letter, so it always starts out with Warren Buffett just having a big long table of annual returns, share price performance of Berkshire Hathaway versus the S&P 500. So now in 2000 and, or after 2020, since 1965, Berkshire Hathaway has delivered 20% return annually to their shareholders, whereas the S&P 500 has delivered 10% annually to shareholders.
That's just insane.
That is insane. So every, well, on average, of course, doesn't happen every single year, but as an average, it does. Berkshire Hathaway will double the performance of the S&P 500. That is really impressive. And I don't, I was trying to think, is there anyone else that would have this track record for this long? And I don't think so. Like, I seriously doubt anyone's got a track record close to this good for sustained for that period of time. Can you think of it? Like, I know Peter Lynch had, you know, 20% returns, but that was only for a period of 13 years. I mean, this is since 1965. This is just remarkable.
Yeah, I don't know of anybody else. Well, one of the tricky things about tracking returns like this is that you'll often see the track records of investors like Peter Lynch when he ran a certain fund. It's just,
that's
true. And it's also very rare that an investor stays either in the same fund for like 3, 4, 5 decades, or has a company like Berkshire where they can just track its performance over, well, now what is that, 40, 55 years? So that also kind of probably plays into it. But yeah, I think Peter Lynch is probably the second longest I can think off the top of my head. Seth Klarman had quite a, I think it was 15 years of a ridiculous rate, this 19% or something. But yeah, certainly 55 years. Have I got that right? 55 years.
Yeah. 15, 20%.
Ridiculous.
That's right.
Ridiculous. Yeah.
And here's the crazy thing. This is doubling the performance of the S&P 500 annually. So you think about that, that's going to compound your money. That's not just like, you know, if you have $100 in both, then if you invested $100 in both in 1965, now the Berkshire Hathaway position's worth double. No. That's doubling every single year. So if you actually look at the total percentage that you would have gained from an investment in Berkshire Hathaway versus the S&P 500 back in 1965, if you're invested in the S&P 500, you end up now at the end of 2020 with a return of 23,000%, which in itself is ridiculous.
Pretty
That's
good.
Very, very strong, very healthy, and you would take that.
Absolutely.
But if you had invested in Berkshire Hathaway, total, you've now got 2.8 million percent. 2.8 million percent. What a crazy number.
It's the power of compounding.
Insane.
It's just
power
crazy.
Power of compounding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what period is it? I think over a 35-year period, if you do 2% better on a compounded basis, that's a doubling in the outcome in the end. So it's no surprise that if you double the percentage, or a 10% gain in this case above the 10% annual return, then it is just astronomical what happens.
That's pretty insane. So yeah, congratulations if you invested in Berkshire Hathaway in 1965. Enjoy your 2.8 million percent return that you've got. Oh dear. I'd be interested to hear if we got any long-term Berkshire Hathaway shareholders that listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
I would probably imagine not, But you never know. So if you're a long-term Berkshire Hathaway shareholder, please let us know in the comments of the YouTube version. All right, moving right along. Mm-hmm. So again, moving on through the Buffett letter. So he talked about Berkshire Hathaway's performance. Berkshire earned $42.5 billion in 2020, which he breaks down into four components. So there's $21.9 billion in operating earnings, then there's $4.9 billion in realized capital gains, and then this is what we always talk about with this funny little accounting rule. In this earnings number of $42.5 billion, there's $26.7 billion worth of unrealized capital gains, and then there's an $11 billion loss from a write-down in the value of a few subsidiary and affiliate businesses that Berkshire Hathaway owns.
Mm.
And this is all, I think Buffett's done this the last few years in a row now, where he's always just said, if you're looking at Berkshire Hathaway as an investment, please just look at our operating earnings.
Mm.
Because if we're following the GAAP accounting principles, then we have to include, if our stock portfolio goes up by $26.7 billion, as it did, even though they didn't sell that, they still have to include it in their earnings, which just... it really just screws over. It means that the earnings of a company like Berkshire Hathaway, which has a big stock portfolio, you just can't trust that number. It doesn't really give you as any information because obviously Berkshire Buffett's, they're not going to turn around and sell their whole stock portfolio in the next year. They're going to hold these businesses for like 10, 15, 20 years. So the unrealized gains or losses that happen from year to year, they really don't mean anything yet. They have to be included.
Yeah, it's really, it's one of those areas I've thought about a little bit, and it's really tricky to figure out how they should deal with it, because in any given year, obviously, it can be absolutely meaningless. I think it was, I don't know, maybe it was in a certain quarter last year where Heinz was doing really poorly, or even, I guess, over March where the markets came down. You'll have these huge unrealized gains, unrealized losses that don't really mean anything for the business. And in the same way, if businesses' stock prices go up a lot in one year, again, it can be meaningless. But over the long term, you kind of do want to realize the gains of their investments because it's a big part of their business. And over the long term, if the stock prices of those businesses are reflecting an increase in value, then it should be there in some way, I think. But yeah, on a year-by-year basis, it just warps the actual earnings figure. It doesn't obviously show you anything to do with how much cash flow the business is actually producing. It's more of a change in, I guess, the value of assets. But yeah, unless you think the market is entirely efficient, you really can't include it on a year-by-year basis. So weird.
Well, I made a video on this and it's going to come out tomorrow. So it will already be out when you're listening to this. But the example that I used in the video is like, if you run your own business, right? And your business makes $100,000 in its first year or in 2019, it makes $100,000. Then in 2020, it makes $1 million. So you've 10x'd, and that's like phenomenal performance. But also as a part of your company, you've got this huge stock portfolio. And because 2019, 2020 have been such volatile years, say you gain $400,000 unrealized gains in 2019, and then you lose $500,000 on paper in 2020. So your business has 10x'd, but if you just look at the earnings, it's actually gone nowhere. It's just been 500,000 both years. So it's this sort of example where, and it only really impacts businesses that have huge stock portfolios, of which there aren't too many. Like Berkshire Hathaway is obviously the biggest. They've got a monster stock portfolio, so it affects them a lot. But you can see how that kind of example is where it doesn't work. But in most instances, it wouldn't actually matter that much for most businesses, I wouldn't imagine. No. Anyway, moving on. Buffett, he talked about, interestingly, I learned something here, how conglomerates got their negative connotation. He told a little story, and because Berkshire Hathaway is a conglomerate, but Buffett definitely pushes back on the idea it's this terrible, horrible business, because I don't know, conglomerate tends to be a negative term, I suppose. So this is really interesting. I actually learned something about how this came to be. So Buffett writes, over time, conglomerates have generally limited themselves to buying businesses in their entirety. That strategy, however, came with two major problems. One was unsolvable. Most of the truly great businesses had no interest in having anyone take them over. So consequently, deal-hungry conglomerateurs had to focus on so-so companies that lacked important and durable competitive strengths. That was not a great pond in which to fish. Beyond that, as conglomerateurs dipped into this universe of mediocre businesses, they often found themselves required to pay a staggering control premium to snare their quarry. Essentially meaning that the price they would have to pay was quite extreme to actually achieve that controlling interest. Mm. It says, aspiring conglomerateurs knew the answer to this overpayment problem. They simply needed to manufacture a vastly overvalued stock of their own so they could then use that as a currency for these pricey acquisitions.
Hmm.
So I find that really interesting. So what would happen is these conglomerates would actually try and pump their own stock price.
Right.
So that even though, you know, they're paying this premium on this other company's price to gain a controlling interest and to actually take it over, it didn't bother them. They were still getting a good deal because, say, they made their own stock price five times its intrinsic value, whereas the price they were paying for this deal of this business they wanted to acquire was only two times the intrinsic value. So it still made sense in a way, but obviously super dodgy way of doing it.
That's interesting. So then they could sell their own shares to raise capital.
Or they could buy the business with shares. Right. They could do a stock payment.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And I guess now, I guess Berkshire is making the distinction that they can buy pieces of really good businesses in cases
exactly
where
right.
they wouldn't be able to buy the entire business. Because if it's a really good business, often it's really hard to buy the entire thing.
Exactly.
Very interesting.
That is exactly what Buffett talked about in this, is that this is why Berkshire Hathaway never ran into this problem that the old conglomerates did, is because they're perfectly happy with buying non-controlling interests in other companies.
Mm.
And because they do their due diligence on the management team. So a lot of the times people want to take over the company so that they can manage it because they think that they're going to manage it better than how it's already being managed.
Yeah.
Whereas Buffett's just like, look, Tim Cook's running Apple. That's fine. We'll buy a non-controlling interest. We won't have to pay up to take that controlling interest in that company. And we'll just let Tim Cook run it. He's great. You know, little bit of faith, little bit of trust. And Buffett says in his letter that, you know, it's fine by us. It's just one less thing that we have to worry about.
That's fascinating.
Which I find pretty funny. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. What else? There wasn't too much else. Interestingly, he talked about the four family jewels of Berkshire Hathaway. So, essentially just listed what he believes the most critical parts of Berkshire Hathaway's business are. And number one, we could have guessed definitely is insurance, because it generates that enormous amount of float, which they can use to make them even more money. Then he said tied second and third is BNSF and Apple, their 5.4% stake in Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth family jewel is Berkshire Hathaway Energy. So I found it interesting actually hearing him list what he believes is most important to the company. What else did he talk about? Share buybacks. So in 2020, Berkshire cleared almost 81,000 A shares off the table, spending $24.7 billion in the process. And he spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the benefits of share buybacks. And he actually used their investment in Apple as an example. So I want to read you this because I found this really interesting. Berkshire's investment in Apple vividly illustrates the power of repurchases. We began buying Apple stock late 2016 and by early July 2018 owned slightly more than 1 billion Apple shares, split adjusted. When we finished our purchases in mid-2018, Berkshire's general account owned 5.2% of Apple. So they had a 5.2% stake. Then he continues, our cost for that stake was $36 billion. Since then, we have enjoyed both regular dividends averaging out to about $775 million annually and have also, in 2020, pocketed an additional $11 billion by selling a small portion of our position. This is the crazy thing, though, and this is what he says here. Despite that sale, voila, Berkshire now owns 5.4% of Apple. That increase was costless to us, coming about because Apple had continuously repurchased its shares, thereby substantially shrinking the number it now has outstanding.
Mm.
That's a pretty good example, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So they sold $11 billion worth of stock. And even after that, because of the severe amount of buybacks that Apple is doing, they've still increased their percentage ownership. That's really interesting. Yeah. Wow, they're
pretty insane.
They're also getting quite a good dividend. $775 million annually on an investment that cost $36 billion.
Yeah, so not bad.
Pretty damn good.
Not bad. Yeah, he's certainly hit the ball out of the park with that investment in Apple, that's for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. But share repurchases are interesting because, of course, if the business has other things that they can use that money for, then you want them to invest within the business. But when you get to a business the size of Apple producing the amount of cash flow that Apple produces, then you can do other things with the cash. You can repurchase your own stock, which means that even if the earnings of Apple doesn't grow in a year, if they pay the same total dollar amount of dividend to a smaller pool of shareholders, then the dividend per share increases for shareholders. So it's a very fascinating that they can do it as long as they're doing it at an appropriate price, as long as they're not paying too much.
Yeah. 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 And I think Berkshire Hathaway, most of their share repurchases would have happened around that March crash because I think they lost 25, 26%. Off of their share price. So they probably would have done most of that then, I would imagine.
Yeah. But, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Pretty impressive. Anyway, that's pretty much it for the Buffett's annual letter to shareholders, Berkshire Hathaway shareholders. The last thing I might add is another interesting quote where he's talking about fixed assets. Mm-hmm. And he actually said, recently I learned a fact about the company that I'd never suspected. Berkshire owns American-based property, plant, and equipment with a gap valuation exceeding the amount owned by any other US company.
Whoa.
So Berkshire's depreciated cost of these domestic fixed assets is $154 billion. Next in line on the list is AT&T with property, plant, and equipment of $127 billion. So this doesn't really mean too much. It's kind of just like an interesting stat that, you know, Berkshire Hathaway owns like the most property, plant, equipment, the most like infrastructure of any company in the United States, which is pretty crazy.
That is crazy. Wow.
But this is actually, so that's like an interesting stat. And obviously, if you have that sort of, if those sort of fixed assets, your business is probably going to be pretty boss. However, this is the little lesson that Buffett chucks in here. He says, our leadership in fixed asset ownership, I should add, does not in itself signal an investment triumph. The best results occur at companies that require minimal assets to conduct high margin businesses and offer goods or services that will expand their sales volume with only minor needs for additional capital. I think that's really the lesson.
Yeah.
Is that, although, yeah, it's fantastic, you know, oh, we've got $150 billion of assets on the ground. The key to the companies, as investors, the companies we should be really eyeing off are the ones where they don't have to put a lot of money in and they can get a lot of money out, so high margin.
Mm-hmm.
And to achieve that scalability, it doesn't cost them the earth either. It's, reaching massive scalability is quite cheap. They're the companies that, really, as an investor, you're like, oh, yeah, here we go. This is good.
Yeah, exactly. It's one thing for a business to spend a lot of money on physical assets, but what's the relationship between the money they're putting into physical assets and the cash flow that's actually being produced or the profit being produced by the business?
Exactly, yeah.
Which is essentially that return on invested capital figure, or looking for businesses that consistently operate at high margins. So, very interesting.
Yep.
Or he's always got lots and lots of little lessons for us sprinkled throughout his letters.
It's going to be sad when he's no longer around.
Yeah.
You know? I look forward to these sort of things. There's so much stuff. It's just good, like when he does interviews or, you know, it's just not going to be the same. Like the Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholder meetings, we're not going to get annual letters from Warren, but it's just going to be sad. Anyway. Sorry to bring the mood down there, no, but anyway.
We can, well, this.
Hopefully we still have many years yet of Warren Buffett content to talk about.
I'm sure we do. I'm sure we do.
All right, let's talk about Charlie Munger. Ooh, talking about old dudes.
So Charlie, he was in the news this week as well. So he did his 2-hour meeting for the Daily Journal, which is a company that he is the chairman of the board on that company. And he obviously invests in the company. And he basically uses this annual meeting to answer questions from shareholders about the company, but it's mostly about investing in the markets in a similar way that the Berkshire annual meeting is now, just people sort of asking questions about
it. Q&A.
Yeah, it's just Q&A, basically. A really, really long Q&A. They spoke about a lot of topics. I highly encourage you to go check out the full 2-hour interview or check out either myself or Brandon's videos on it. I don't think you haven't made a video on it yet, but you probably will be.
I'm about to.
There, by the time you're listening to this, there probably is a video. There's probably one on my channel, so go watch mine first. Mine's probably better So
go watch Hamish's. That one's definitely there.
Mine's definitely there. Brandon's will be there. No, but they spoke about a lot of different topics. Maybe I'll just pick out a couple that were interesting. He spoke about, he had a question about what was driving the Daily Journal stock price and then the stock prices of businesses generally in 2020. And he actually attributes a lot of the stock price increases in 2020 to two things. One, speculative investing. So people just gambling on share prices going up, gambling that the Fed's going to come out and say something nice and the markets will go up or something along those lines. And also forced index fund buying. So what he's talking about when he says forced index fund buying is, of course, whenever someone buys an index fund, right? Someone invests passively and doesn't really look at the businesses in the index, they're just buying a little piece of everything, then that fund, whether it be Vanguard or BlackRock or some other fund, they have to go out and buy a little piece of those businesses. And it can add up, especially if you're talking about the businesses that have a significant part of an index. So the FANG stocks, for example, which hold a big percentage of the S&P 500, meaning, you know, for every dollar that's going into an index fund without anybody thinking about it, because a lot of people just buy index funds passively, they dollar cost average, they expect, well, it's gone up at 10% per year in the past. So it can, you know, if I just invest passively, I don't really need to think about the businesses in the fund. Yep. For every dollar going in, you know, a significant amount of that is going towards, blindly going towards these big tech businesses. So it was interesting to hear him talk about those things as factors that he thinks influenced share prices in 2020. He also spoke about the GameStop short squeeze. There was a couple of questions directed about that specifically. He had quite a colorful response to say.
This was funny, wasn't it?
It was very funny. Yes. So he basically called the retail investors who participated in it basically gamblers, and he aligned their actions similar to what people do when they gamble at the horse races. So basically arguing that it's just pure speculation, that people are jumping in and hoping that it goes up and not actually fundamentally analyzing the business in any significant way. Interestingly, he also went on and attacked, well, he didn't directly attack Robinhood, but it was pretty clear that's what he was talking about.
Yeah.
He basically went on and attacked brokerage free sites for encouraging this speculation and frenzy. I mean, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. What do you think about that? Do you think that Robinhood encourages people to gamble in the markets similar to what happened with GameStop or
I think that they do push it too far. And to be honest, because I live in Australia, I don't use Robinhood. We haven't got it available to us. But I have seen some screenshots of what some brokerage free sites look like. And in my opinion, they are too simplistic. For example, I saw one where the interface was just like, you know, you'd click on a stock, say Tesla, and then your options would be like, I think it's going to go up, and then you might click on that. And then the other option was, I think it's going to go down, and you'd click on that. And then they're like, oh, short, would you like to short sell this? This is betting that the stock price will go down. So I think when you start presenting you know, quite a serious topic like short selling and that sort of thing as quite simply, you know, I think the stock's going down.
Mm.
Without, you know, really explaining it. I think that's a little bit gone a little bit too far.
Yeah.
And look, I think there's really two sides to this because brokerage free platforms, there's no doubt they have done a great thing in the investing community, and they have opened up. They've increased accessibility to the public markets for anyone that wants to start investing.
Mm-hmm.
However, because we've spoken about this with the GameStop thing, because they do it in a brokerage-free way, so anyone that saved up $500 can go and make an account and invest brokerage-free in a company that they want to buy. The problem is that these brokerage-free brokers are businesses at the end of the day, and they have to make money, because if they don't make money, then they're going to go bust, and that's not good for anybody.
They don't make money.
So they have to find these different ways to monetize their platform, and obviously one of the ways they do it is they sell their order flow to whoever wants to buy it, to the big hedge funds or whatever, so they can, you know, essentially be front runners. I know front running is technically illegal, but still definitely happens. Which means really the actual market price, usually when you're buying a stock on Robinhood, you're actually going to get a slightly worse deal. Mm. So you're actually going to end up buying at a slightly higher price. But if you're a long-term shareholder that's going to, you know, you like a stock at $50 and say you buy it for $50.05, but you think you want to hold it for 10 years and you think it's going to 150, like that's not going to matter. But in the moment, I mean, especially for people that are trading and are in and out all the time, then that might have more of an impact. But I think really Charlie Munger says that, you know, I think he was asked in this what the biggest con in the stock market is or something at the moment. And he said, I don't know, but brokerage-free brokers are right up there. Or he says something like that. Yeah. And I think the main reason he said that because the lack of transparency, the lack of communication from these brokers saying, look, yes, we do offer brokerage-free services, but the reason that we can do that is because we make money this way, which you can always find, you know, if you dig deep into the FAQs or whatever. But I think it's just the lack of being upfront, the lack of they just make themselves seem like this god of a program, which is all marketing and whatever. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, they make money on margin as well, providing margin to a lot of people who probably shouldn't have it. But I think certainly having these brokerage-free sites, even fractional shares where you can invest really small amounts of money, I think it's overall a good thing that they exist. But I think you would be lying if you said that there weren't, you know, new challenges or new consequences that have been created by those sites. So, yeah, it was interesting to hear his take on that. He was also asked if he thought we were seeing another tech bubble, so similar to the dot-com bubble that happened in the year 2000 or 98 to 2000. And his answer on this was a one-liner, like a lot of his answers. He basically just said yes, but he doesn't know when it's going to pop. So,
I think that'd be most people's sentiment at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at the biggest, I mean, we spoke about this last week, the aggregate PE of 60 for big tech companies, and Tesla sitting at 1,000 at the moment, or maybe they're a little bit under that now that they've come off a little bit. But it's certainly there are businesses, maybe not everything, but certainly if you look at individual businesses, even ones that are producing a lot of profit, there's businesses that are very, very expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. What else did he talk about?
Yeah.
There was a lot of little bits and pieces that I learned that I didn't know but probably aren't revolutionary.
Yeah, he gave a brief answer on Bitcoin, but very similar to what he said in the past, that he considers it very, very similar to gold in that it's a non-productive asset. So he doesn't really have any interest in investing in it or predicting where its price will trend over time. He spoke about diversification and that he thinks diversification is actually a bad thing if you're a stock picker. So he basically said, it's easier to pick 5 good investments rather than 100. And that's kind of a bit of a dig towards what a lot of active fund managers do, which is they have these portfolios of 100, 200, 300 businesses that they're not passively investing. It's not like they buy 500 businesses because they are the biggest market cap businesses and they're tracking an index. They're picking 300-400 businesses actively. They're getting in and out of them on a year-by-year basis. Oh, this business had weaker earnings than I expected, so I'm going to sell that one. This one had really good earnings and they're expected to grow this year, so I'm going to buy that one. Charlie basically thinks doing that is just spreading yourself too thin, that you can't possibly pick 100 good investments and that if you focus on a few, you would do a lot better. There was a couple of other things, but I could probably talk for a very long time covering all of them. Those were some of the major things that I covered in my video and that were covered in the interview. But yeah, I highly recommend you go check out the full interview. It's on Yahoo Finance on their YouTube channel, I think. So
yeah, I think the thing about the Charlie Munger, you know, Q&As is that there are so many because he doesn't ramble on like Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
He's just straight to the point. So because of that, there are a lot of questions that get asked in like the same time period. I think this went for 2 hours. So I definitely encourage you, you know, if you've got a couple of hours or maybe you're on a long drive or you're going for a run or something like that, just look up the Daily Journal, what was it, annual meeting, and just have a listen to the Q&A section, and there'll be a lot of different topics covered and a lot of different things to think about from Charlie Munger. I mean it's all stuff that's the interesting thing I took out from it is there's nothing really brand new that we hear, and Charlie Munger admits that himself. He said, because I think they were like, oh, are there any updates to poor Charlie's almanac or anything, any other new things you've been thinking about? And he was basically like, you know, I think I've pretty much said what I want to say. I don't think I've really got too much more to add, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, he's full.
But fair enough. He's been investing for so long. He's written books. He's done year after year of meetings and speeches and whatever that, you know, he probably has gotten his point across.
Yeah, I think he's had his time to go through his learning curve and change his principles. The last 20 years, his principles have just stayed the exact same. And you can't really blame him for that, considering his age and the life that he's lived as well. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I spoke briefly about Tesla just then. This is a bit of a non-story, but Tesla is coming
off. It's been cooling off. Well, it's a story because Tesla isn't going up.
Yes.
I thought there was a condition of the – I thought there was in the terms and agreements of the stock market somewhere. Didn't I sign that when I signed up for my Robinhood account that Tesla only goes up?
Jeez, you would think so if you looked at the stock last year. The stock was up 1,000% last year.
Wow. Which is sign of the times,
just crazy. But no, it's down 26% over the past 4 weeks. So it's obviously still massively up on what it was last year. But it's a big change of direction for the stock.
It is, isn't it?
I actually looked, because if you remember at the start of the year, we made some predictions, and you forced me to make a prediction about Tesla, even though I didn't want to.
Oh, did I? Cop that.
We both said that we thought that Tesla would be down in 2021, that at the end of the year, it would be lower than it was at the start of the year.
Is it currently down?
And it is currently now down just for the year.
We'll take that as a win.
What are we at the start of March here? So we're right so far. Where do you think it's going from here?
Oh, look, like anyone's guess, obviously. But I don't know. I mean, because the market's been down a bit lately as well, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So I would imagine, you know, all things considered, I think the market will probably just keep going up, in all honesty. So I think that Tesla's probably going to keep going up as well. So I don't know. I'd probably imagine it would finish up at the end of the year, but who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to stick by Down. I have to believe. Right. One time I've got to be right on Tesla. I've been wrong so many times.
Oh, dear.
It has 1,000 PE.
I know. But, I mean, this is our argument. I know it's got 1,000 P, but look at the market. Look at what's been happening. How are you surprised? Nothing surprises us anymore. It's like I could start a failing, I don't even know, horse and cart business, and I'd probably be able to IPO it for $15 billion.
Yeah, pretty bad.
I could start a bedpan business and I could get an IPO of at least $5 billion at the moment.
Brendan, you don't even need a business these days. You just do what's called a SPAC and you raise money for a business that you haven't even started or haven't even bought yet. It's literally
raised. Do you want to buy it? Guys, if you would like to buy into the Young Investors podcast SPAC, please go to younginvestors.spac.com.
Yeah, we're raising $1 billion. We're going to take $100 million in fees. And if we can't find a stock.
$100 million in fees. We have absolutely no idea what we're going to buy. Yeah. But look, you just got to trust us, okay? Just trust us. We know what we're doing.
Yeah. And look, if we can't find anything, that's just the way it goes sometimes. We'll give you 90% of your money back. And we're going to keep our $100 million for our research time, for our time taken researching.
But, exactly.
But then we're going to have SPAC 2.0.
SPAC 2.0 is the one you want to watch out
one,
for.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, get it on. Yeah.
We might actually buy something with SPAC 2.0.
Yes, yeah.
You just never know. So look out for that. But of course, because we might buy something, the premium's going to go up. Maybe we'll take $200 million.
Maybe.
Then we can have $100 million each. That'd be nice.
That would be good. Yeah. I have to cut this bit out.
Don't give away our gameplay. Anyway, the sad thing is there are a lot of people out there that would treat like their audience like that.
Yeah.
You're just another dollar sign to me. I'm going to monetize you for all you're worth. I am kind of glad that we are not like that.
Yeah.
It's just like, whatever it is, thank you, Mum and Dad, for instilling some sort of moral compass in me somewhere.
Some level of ethics.
Yeah, I know. Jeez, it blows my mind how some of these... That's a whole nother topic. Let's move on before we open that can. Q&A?
Yeah, let's do some Q&A. All right. Where do you want to go first?
I don't know. I have to be honest, I forgot to read what was in the Q&A. Let's do this one. Let's just go from the top down.
Hey guys, great podcast. Thank you very much. Would love to hear in a bit of detail around what margin of safety is, how you calculate and why. Keep up the good work.
Okay. Thanks for the question, first of all. Margin of safety. How do we even explain margin of safety? So, you got to think about the business you want to buy, and it's going to have some. You're going to do a lot of calculations. You're going to essentially educated guess how it's going to perform into the future, and you're going to come to this usually through a discounted cash flow analysis. You're going to come to this value of what you believe the business is worth. That's the intrinsic value, but you do all these calculations and essentially we're looking out, how's Apple going to perform over the next 10 years? Well, we can look to the past. They've grown at this rate. Management's doing a good job, whatever. But at the end of the day, we're still guessing. Yes, it's an educated guess, but we don't know what the future holds because it hasn't happened yet. So there is the potential that somewhere along the line, we're going to make some there's not even the potential. It's a reality that somewhere along the line, there is going to be some level of error in our calculation of intrinsic value. So the margin of safety is exactly what it sounds like. It is a margin of safety for that business valuation. So say we estimate that in, 10 years, Apple's going to be worth $3 trillion or something. We might go, okay, yeah, but there's going to be, we don't quite know what the future's going to hold. So maybe we will give ourselves, we'll take a 30% discount off of that intrinsic value to give ourselves 30% of error, essentially. So if we bought, if we were able to buy the business at 70, or even if we were able to ideally buy it at only 50% of its intrinsic value, then we can still be very, very wrong in our estimations of the future, and we can still make a great return. So that's kind of how I explain the margin of safety. You find that intrinsic value, but you're not 100% confident in that intrinsic value. You're reasonably confident, but you don't know. So you take that margin of safety off, so that you are, it essentially greatly reduces your risk of losing money in the investment.
Yeah. Excellent explanation. Well,
Would you add anything to that?
Probably not. Yeah, I think it's important to what you said there, in that it could be that you make an error in your valuation, but it's also just that stuff happens that you just can't foresee.
COVID.
COVID, for example. Even if COVID only lasts a year or impacts a business for 1 year, it can have a big impact on the cash flows that business produces over, say, a 5-year period or over a 10-year period. And that's just...
They're paying back debt and blah, blah, blah.
And it's just something you can't predict. I think the only thing I would add is maybe an example. Think of it this way. If you think that a stock could go to $200 per share and you want to double your money, for example, with no margin of safety, you would be happy to buy the stock at 100, right? Because you buy it at 100, you think it goes to 200. If it goes to 200, you double your money. Adding a 50% margin of safety would be like buying the stock at $50 per share, because then even if the stock underperforms what you expect, even if you first expect it to go to 200, but it only goes to 100, so it underperforms by 50%, in that case, you have still doubled your money. You've still made,
you've still done
what you wanted to do, which was double your investment. So that's kind of just a simple example of how a margin of safety allows the business to perform worse than you expect, based on your initial calculations, and still make you the return that you desire. So,
yeah, absolutely, cool. Absolutely, very good. All right, let me ask this one to you. We'll do this one. Hi, Brandon and Hamish. I love your podcasts and usually listen to them whilst doing my weekly 10K run. Oh, very good. Good on you. Get out there and do some exercise. Hamish, you mentioned that this was a goal of yours for the year, and that's awesome. Have you hit that goal yet? Just out of curiosity.
No, let's not talk about that.
Let's not talk about that. All right, we won't talk about that. I was wondering if either of you can please offer some information regarding stock maintenance, i.e. once you purchase a position, what next and how to manage your investment? I've done your Profitful course, Brandon, and it's amazing for a beginner. Oh, thank you very much. But I did find myself wondering what happens once I've invested. Fair enough. Do I need to scour annual reports yearly and adjust my position, etc.? Thanks in advance and keep up the great content.
Yeah, that's a...
Hamish, what do you reckon? Yeah,
that's a really good question. There's not too much that I do if I've invested in a business, then it's one that I clearly think is a really strong business. And typically... businesses that meet the requirements that I'm looking for, they don't change too much on a year-by-year basis. So there's nothing dramatic that's going to happen usually for a business over a year, but each year, so each quarter, I will, I'll read the quarterly report, the press release, I'll listen to the conference call if it's there, but I'm not doing any kind of serious deep analysis usually. It's usually just kind of a brief check on how the business is performing in that quarter. At the end of the year, I will update my spreadsheet. So I have a free stock analysis spreadsheet, if you're not aware. I use that, and each year I update that and I go through the annual report, and I'll really just be looking to see if the business is on track or not. So more or less, is it on track? Has anything substantially changed in the business? Did any of the management team change? Are they moving into any new markets, or was there any new competitors that impacted their business or anything like that at all? But in terms of buying or changing the position itself, changing the investment, that's not something I would typically do. Based on a yearly basis, usually that will just depend on if the stock gets really, really cheap throughout the year, then maybe I'm adding to it. Usually not going to sell a really great business at all. That's pretty much what I do on a year by year basis. Of course, if something substantially changes in the business that either makes it one I no longer understand, or I no longer like the management team or something like that, then maybe I'll consider selling the investment. But that's not something that happens on a year-by-year basis. That is a rare occurrence for something that I've invested in.
Mm.
Do you have any thoughts on this question?
Yeah, just generally just keeping up to speed. That's what I do. Like, you just got to read the quarterlies. I mean, generally speaking, you're not going to do too much because hopefully, as you said, when you get into a stock, you're thinking about holding it for a long time. So just read through quarterly reports, listen to conference calls, you know, continually update your valuation and that sort of thing. Mm. And that's pretty much, you just got to keep up to speed. The worst thing is just going to sleep on a stock, you know, and this usually happens when you make a big capital on an unrealized capital gain. So for example, for me, it would be like Tesla's gone up 10x since I bought it. So I feel pretty good now. So I'm still a shareholder, but I'm kind of just going to fall asleep on that stock a little bit because I'm up so much. And then I stop listening to the quarterly, you know, the quarterly calls, and, you know, I don't do my valuations, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, before I know it, something goes wrong, and then I've lost all the money I made. That's really the thing that's going to get you, is that almost that it's kind of like complacency when you have a lot of big gain on paper. Just make sure that you don't get complacent. Keep up to speed.
Mm.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
That's pretty much
it. Should we leave the podcast there for today?
Yeah, I think so. That's pretty much coming in bang on an hour. Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And on those questions, if you do have more questions for next week or even news topics or anything like that you want us to cover in next week's podcast, then head over to the YouTube version of the podcast at youtube.com/TheYoungInvestorsPodcast. Click on the latest episode, scroll down to the comment section, and you can leave your questions and topics there. Thanks, everyone, as I said, for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Thanks, ShareSite, for sponsoring, as always. ShareSite.com/YoungInvestors if you want to try a free account or a paid account for 33% off. Thanks, Brandon, for joining me, as always.
So good. Good to chat. Yeah.
And right. We'll be back next week. See you later, guys.
See you guys.